Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese of Vanderbilt. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we interview philosophers about their new books in aesthetics and ethics, metaphysics and epistemology, social and political philosophy, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, and many other areas. Today's interview is with Jesse Prinz, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the City University of New York Graduate Center. His new book, The Conscious Brain, is just out from Oxford University Press. For decades now, philosophers, linguists, psychologists, and neuroscientists have been working to understand the nature of the hard-to-describe but very familiar conscious experiences we have while we're awake. Some have thought consciousness can't be explained scientifically, and others have argued that it will always remain a mystery beyond our epistemic grasp. But most consider some sort of explanation in physical and specifically neural terms to be possible. In this deftly written book, Prinz synthesizes scientific data and hypothesis with philosophical theory and insight to argue for what he calls the AIR, or AIR theory, according to which consciousness is attention to intermediate-level sensory representations realized by neural activity or vector waves, attention is availability to working memory, and availability to working memory is identified with synchronized neural or vector wave activity in the gamma frequency range. Along the way, he provides novel arguments against competitor theories, presents new data that any adequate theory of consciousness must explain, and proposes a mind-body metaphysics that draws on insights from both non-reductive and reductive physicalism. Let's turn to the interview. I'm here with Jesse Prinz, the author of The Conscious Brain, How Attention Engenders Experience. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Carrie. Great to be here.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for agreeing to an interview. This is a terrific book. It's deftly written, as usual. It's also empirically synthetic, and it's just comprehensive in all kinds of ways and at lots of different levels. And I guess the best way to get at the book would be to look at your background interests, how you came to this book, and then get into the particular details of your theory of consciousness. But actually, before we get to that, one of the they say that you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, and in this particular case, I'm just wondering how to judge the cover of the book, because the cover itself is extremely interesting. It's a woman who has yellow eyes with no pupils, and the font of the title is in this like amazing sort of retro horror movie type font. And it looks, instead of like a serious sort of philosophical treatise of, theory of consciousness, it looks more like a Bodice Ripper horror novel. So I just, if you could just explain a little bit about the cover, which you provided the art for it. So could you explain just, what this cover means in terms of what is inside the cover?
Well, it actually begins with the title, because I, oddly enough, in choosing The Conscious Brain as a title, I hadn't even thought about The Conscious Mind, Dave Chalmers' very seminal book on consciousness. So even though that contrast is in some ways obvious, since his book is very philosophical and mine is very biological, I wasn't thinking of the comparison. I just thought it's a book that's data-driven, and the data I'm drawing on is by and large neuroscientific, so The Conscious Brain seemed like the natural title. But as soon as I had that title in hand, it kept suggesting to me these old horror films. It really had the ring to me of the name of some, like the Attack of the Killer Brain kind of film.
Right.
So my mental image associated with The Conscious Brain was always the aesthetic of a vintage horror poster.
Yeah.
And when I floated the idea of doing a cover that gestured to that, my editor, Peter Aline, was wonderfully supportive to my surprise and delight. And I executed the painting, knowing that it could get vetoed at any time. And one of the ironies is it actually did get vetoed. So the the first version of the cover was a painting of a woman with her brain exposed.
Oh, God.
So much more literal. but of course, you know, it was a woman who looked like she had been the victim of some terrible unhappiness. I mean, a zombie woman or an alien invader victim. So I think that the combination of her tortured expression and the exposed brain made it look a little bit violent. So the design studio at Oxford vetoed it. And the joke at the time is that they were vetoing a picture of a woman because her brain was exposed. They didn't want to show a woman with a brain. So that there was a kind of running joke that this was really a misogynistic veto, that the idea of revealing that women actually had brains would somehow be offensive. But they kindly agreed to let me conceal the brain, and the image that resulted was actually derived from, I took the neural pattern of an attention study done with EEG. So what you see there is actually a red pattern on her forehead.
Right.
Quite literally taken from data of attention in the brain.
Okay.
So she has an attentive brain, but the typography goes with the horror aesthetic.
Yes.
And I think that sorry about the beeping outside, by the way, we're getting some conscious qualia right now. I don't know if you're picking that up.
Yes,
sir. But that should pass. This is live from New York. But the cover really was to me a nice way of saying, look, philosophy is a serious business. We all take ourselves seriously, but it's okay to have a sense of humor too. It's a very scholarly book, but consciousness is a fun, exciting, to some extent, new and dynamic topic. It's informed by the latest research. So to have something that was a little bit less academic, I thought was okay.
I think it definitely works. So could you, to get into the book, how did you get to this book? 'Cause you've been working in a lot of, you've drawn on some of your past work here. So how did you, what's your sort of philosophical journey to this particular book?
Well, my first exposure to philosophy of mind was probably through questions about consciousness. I was an undergrad at NYU and I took philosophy of mind with Tom Nagel. And I really at the time was not primarily interested in philosophy of mind. I was doing mostly logic and a number of other things. And Nagel's approach was in some ways frustrating to me because there was a tendency, as you find in a lot of his work, to problematize things. So when we would get to questions about consciousness and qualia, it really was always a stopping place where he would just say there seem to be these irreducible features of the mental that we can never adequately explain in physical terms. And at that point, the conversation just needs to stop. And I was so vexed by that, I think, that I really didn't even think philosophy of mind was an area I wanted to pursue. Around the same time, maybe a little after that, Dan Dennett's book appeared. And I learned about it, I think, first from a New York Times review of it, which kind of brought attention to the chutzpah of the title, Consciousness Explained, and in some ways drew attention to the fact that Dennett's more biological approach wasn't all that successful in shedding light on these deep mysteries. But still, Dennett's book was a watershed. I mean, for me, it really represented not just a turn in how to think about consciousness, but a turn in philosophy, because to see philosophers drawing so heavily on empirical evidence was very inspirational. And while it took me a little while to get back to consciousness, that book loomed in my mind as a model of this alternative way, this way of doing philosophy that wasn't about wallowing in problems, but trying to really offer richly informed solutions. And in grad school, I continued to have a background interest in consciousness. And towards the end of my grad career, Murat Aydede came to my graduate program, which was the University of Chicago. And Murat was fresh off of a postdoc. He was a recently minted PhD, and he had a good friend, Gavin Gezeldera, who had written a dissertation on consciousness. And Gavin had gotten Fred Dretske interested in the topic. Fred had not been doing consciousness studies before that, and Fred, in his book on consciousness, credits Kevin with making him realize that consciousness is actually an interesting thing to work on. And around this time, Fred's book came out, Michael Tye's book came out, there was a sort of discovery of the work that Brian Lohr was doing on phenomenal concepts. People, of course, were continuing to discuss the Dennett work, and shortly thereafter, Dave's book came out. But Murat taught a consciousness seminar at just the time when these things were really in preprint form. So because of his connections, we were able to read a number of these things before they appeared, and we read them pretty closely. And I think that that really sealed my interest in the topic. And in fact, papers I was writing for Murat, or writing in the context of those readings in the mid-90s, really led to this project. They were the core of the theory. Most of it was already in place at that time. My first publication in philosophy was on consciousness. And I think after about a dozen sort of more publications on consciousness, I realized that absolutely no one was reading them. So I'd say sometimes have a conversation with somebody working in consciousness studies, and they would be surprised to discover that I worked on consciousness. And I've published a dozen papers on consciousness, and they'd say, where? And I'd say, well, in the main consciousness journals, where else? So it wasn't as if these things were hidden from view, but I do think books have a way of reaching people that articles don't. And I had thought about the topic from so many different angles that it really was a book-length project at that point. There were enough different things to say that I thought I should bring this all together, expand on it, and present it in that form.
So one of the first questions that has to be asked in this area of the philosophical universe is what you mean by consciousness. I mean, you know, part of the issue is always, you know, how are we going to talk about it? And people introduce different labels, you know, qualia, of course, phenomenal character, you know, access consciousness, which you also discussed, Bloch's notion, what it's like, of course, Tom Nagel. And so you get a lot of different labels being lofted about. And so I think probably the best way to start is for you to explain how you use these terms and what you mean.
Yeah, I think obviously it's tricky. This is the starting place for a lot of discussion in the area. I've tended to like to think of consciousness as experience, and some people like Uriah Kriegel just offer that as a synonym and move on and continue to talk about experience. But, you know, that's swapping synonyms for synonyms. And I think there's something to the idea that consciousness can't be defined. In fact, it's precisely its resistance to definition that contributes to skepticism about various kinds of physical or functional theories of consciousness. So if people try to define it by pointing in some way. And I think probably a version of that is right. I don't say this in the book, but one thing that's occurred to me is in a way consciousness is the obvious thing. It's all we know. Mm-hmm. And we look at the history of philosophy and we see that the unconscious is a fairly recent discovery. That's something that people weren't aware of. And that's because the conscious mind is the aspects of the mind that are given to us, the ones that are present to us, the ones that we know directly from the inside, as it were. So one way to just define consciousness is to say, in any task of this kind, you're trying to do a sorting where you have two bins, one for the category you're interested in and one for everything else. And with respect to consciousness, we could say the conscious mind is the aspects of the mind we know from within, and the unconscious mind includes all those aspects of the mind that we need to be told about from the third person, that need to be discovered, that aren't available to us in some way through direct experience. So I think as a first cut, that's kind of useful. The other thing, as I would say, and this really follows on the heels of people like David Rosenthal, we should in consciousness studies distinguish questions about the qualitative character of experience and questions about how they become conscious. And I do think these are intimately related, maybe more intimately related than David Rosenthal does. But I think there's one question, which is what distinguishes two conscious states from another, and another question, how do all conscious states, regardless of what they're like, become conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that division of labor helps us see that there may be two things to define. And that very rough way of doing the sort is maybe a definition of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Consciousness can be defined as the aspects of the mental we know about without reliance on third-person methods. And then qualia, which become more difficult to define, could be characterized in a way that's parasitic on that first definition. Say, of those things we know about first personally, mm-hmm. What distinguishes any pair of them that are different? And a theory of qualia will be a theory of those distinctions.
Okay. So your theory, the AIR or AIR, do you call it AIR or AIR?
I call it AIR. It's unfortunate because with David Rosenthal as a colleague, Dave Chalmers pointed out that now our department
hot
can be
AIR. Yeah. I guess that was, you know, yeah, that was obvious. Okay. So your half of the hot AIR is the AIR part. And, the AIR theory, of course, involves the idea of attention, of intermediate level representations. And then there's this, what is not included in the AIR is the relationship between the intermediate level representations as being realized by a certain type of neural activity, and that when this neural activity occurs in a particular way, it's synchronized in a particular frequency, that's when you have a conscious experience. So maybe you could start us off by saying a little bit about each of the three, I guess I've identified, three parts of the theory.
Absolutely. So the first thing for me was really the levels. And I think that here the clear hero of my story is Ray Jackendoff. And I was extremely interested in theories of vision before I started working in earnest on consciousness. I was at the time primarily working on perceptual foundations of cognition, and people like David Marr loomed large as pioneers in vision science. And in 1987, before I was thinking about these issues seriously, Ray Jackendoff wrote a book called Consciousness and the Computational Mind. And Jackendoff's insight was just that if we begin with something like Marr's theory of vision, which has a three-stage hierarchy, we can ask a question, where in that hierarchy does consciousness arise? So if you think about any perceptual system as having the task of going from very local or discrete sensory receptors all the way up to representations that can be invariant enough to recognize objects across transformations in space, we immediately get this picture on which there's a three-part hierarchy. You have a beginning stage at which you still just have the little discrete bits. So for vision, you take the retina, which is basically a grid of photoreceptive cells, and you project it onto the neocortex, and you have early vision. And early vision is just giving you these little edges, little bits of color, but hasn't yet connected the dots, as it were. And then to make progress on this, to discover the structure of the external world, the dots need to get connected. So you need a second stage where all these little dots, all the edges, become coherent wholes, and figure and background are separated, three-dimensional depth is added, textures and coherent object parts all take on form. It's possible we can imagine a creature that got by with just that level of representation, because at that point we're seeing a world of objects, of concrete things located in space. But it turns out that the senses really benefit from abstracting away from some of the details that you get at that level of representation to a higher level of representation that would be invariant across transformations in space. So if you're looking at an object in front of you and you simply change your viewpoint slightly, maybe the object moves or you move, you need to be able to keep track of the fact that it's the same object you're viewing. And if you see an object on one occasion and then on another occasion from a different vantage point, you need to be able to recognize that they're tokens of the same type. So vision and all the senses seem to extrapolate abstract representation that is going to exclude a lot of these very specific features of vantage point and give a rise to a kind of structural description that tells you what the object is like intrinsically, independent of how it's being viewed. So that was Mars theory, and lots of successor theories, including theories derived from neuroscience, have had that basic organization. Jackendoff says, if you look at this picture and ask, what is consciousness like? The answer is that it's in the middle, that second stage of representation. We don't experience a world of little discrete edges. We experience a world of coherent bounded objects. Mm-hmm. And we don't experience a world that abstracts away from vantage point. If you look out at an object, you always see it from a particular point of view. And so the first part of the theory is really an effort to take Jackendoff's insight and say that it's consistent with and, in fact, strongly supported by contemporary neuroscience. So Jackendoff's book doesn't even mention the brain. What I try to do is walk through all kinds of evidence from neuroimaging to single-cell recording to deficit work and try and show that even though there are many, many visual areas, they can be organized into a three-part hierarchy, and the intermediate level within that hierarchy is privilege vis-a-vis consciousness. So evidence includes things like the mid-level cells carry the kind of information people report experiencing. The mid-level cells correlate in time with conscious experience, and destruction of mid-level cells impairs or eliminates consciousness, whereas destruction of other levels does not. So it's really an endorsement of an extant view, Jackendoff's view, that constitutes the first part of the theory.
And let me just, before we get to the availability so a lot of, one of the things that you do in the book, and you do mention this at the end, is that it does rest a lot on vision science, as your explanation has just shown. And for vision science, the intermediate level, it makes sense. We can kind of understand that from Marr and other people. One of the claims that you make is that this intermediate level of representation, that sensory representations are all the kinds of experiences, conscious experiences that we have. Could you explain that? In particular, so for example, thoughts that don't seem to have any sort of sensory image, present, thoughts about numbers or about the future, or more cognitive states other than perceptual states, So I guess the question is, first of all, how do you extend the claim that it's the intermediate level to other aspects of other kinds of conscious states where that idea of an intermediate level doesn't seem to naturally fall out? And then also, to some extent, is there any worry that depending heavily on vision science, on the perception end of the mind, might in a sense have skewed your data set in terms of, where you're drawing the neuroscience from to support the theory?
Good. Yeah. Obviously, the topic of cognitive phenomenology of thought, has finally gotten attention, and it's long overdue. So I think that really is one of the exciting areas of growth in consciousness studies. I think the cord is still out there. In a certain way, my task with respect to cognition is a bit easier given some background assumptions. I'm a concept empiricist. So for me, a sharp divide between concepts and perception, between cognition and perception, is already ruled out from the get-go. So for me, when asked, can you have cognitive phenomenology, I want to say, well, sure, because cognition is couched in a perceptual code. Therefore, to the extent we can be conscious of perception, we can be conscious of perceptual states, mental images, for instance, that are serving a cognitive function. And I think it's useful to think about this a little bit in evolutionary terms. If we were nonverbal animals, if we were creatures that just got by the way we might expect other mammals to get by, this worry about cognitive phenomenology sort of wouldn't arise. It would be very natural to think that the mind is a it's a kind of perception machine. It's this input-output system that perceives the external world and then uses those perceptions to plan and make decisions about what to do next. And the idea that the mental life of the conscious mental life of a non-human mammal is exhausted by perceptual states seems almost like the default position. It would be the exceptional, the position that would require argument to show that there's a cognitive component to an animal's life that extends beyond perceptual representation. And I think an interesting possibility that's suggested by consciousness studies is that if you look at the kinds of cognition that seem to outstrip perception in us, they seem to be verbally mediated. So when you get into very abstract domains and you ask, how do people conceptualize these domains, like maybe topics that come up in philosophy, independent of the images we form, a natural answer is that these are linguistically mediated. If you try to think about some very abstruse problem in analytic metaphysics independent of language, it would be very difficult, maybe impossible. So a suggestion now becomes that mammals are these perception machines. We're basically input-output machines that are designed to behave in response to what we perceive. And as evolution advances, we get a bit fancier, and we can start to store perceptual information in order to plan and make decisions about actions that are informed by past experience. So we can now use perceptual information offline in the form of mental imagery. And consciousness might be important for that. So if you think about the role of consciousness in deliberation, there's something about this kind of pause button where instead of immediately responding to the visual world or the sensory world, we stop and utilize or in some way executively manipulate information. That looks like something consciousness might be implicated in. But I think when we get to human cognition, there's this other thing that happens. And you can think of it as an invention. Language is this tool that we create somehow at some point in our past. And this tool is successful for two reasons. And one reason is that language has this wonderful feature of being able to represent things at any level of abstraction in precisely the same way. So a word for a concrete object like apple is no more complex than a word for a complex, very, very abstract property like infinity. And I think once you get a system that has that kind of representational economy, it's extremely powerful for cognition. But language is another feature that we're not often attuned to, which is that it's actually perceivable. Language is just a string of sounds or gestures. It's a set of arbitrary marks that we can in some way manipulate in our minds the same way we would manipulate images of very concrete things. So the same way you might form a mental image of an apple and rotate it, you can form a mental image of the word apple, an auditory image. And what language does because of its imageability is it makes the most abstract domains, like mathematics, to use the infinity example, as imageable as the most concrete domains. So language greatly extends our cognitive abilities by turning the most abstract domains into something that is concrete. But if you're working against that background, I think it's really plausible to think of language and to think of cognition in general as these perceptual items. And once you think of them as perceptual items, a theory of consciousness that focuses on perception no longer looks to be at odds with the idea of cognitive phenomenology. So in the book, I don't spend a lot of time trying to argue for this empiricist perspective, because I want a more theory-neutral defense of the view that there's no cognitive phenomenology above and beyond perception. But sort of stepping back from the more specific constraints of the book, I think it really is plausible, both phenomenologically, but also thinking about the nature of thought and the evolution of minds, to take cognition as just a special use of our perceptual capacities.
So on this language, and then we'll go back to the main theory, language as we speak it or think it would be intermediate.
Yes, exactly. So this is obviously a place where some pressure could be put on the theory. Jackendoff is a psycholinguist, and when he advanced the intermediate level hypothesis, one of his core examples was language. And he said, look, we have all of these theories about what's going on in terms of syntactic trees and even phonemic representations that involve a fair amount of structure. We really don't have conscious access to those local details like the phonemes or those very invariant abstract details like the syntactic trees. What we're aware of is just strings of speech sounds. Right. And I think that if you are convinced by the kinds of Jackendoff arguments, the idea that awareness of language is at the intermediate level becomes very plausible.
Okay, so that's the IR part of the air.
Yes.
And now we get to the attention. That's part two.
Good. So in reading Jackendoff, I was very quickly convinced. And I thought the theory was right, but missing something. And what it was missing is an account of when these intermediate level representations become conscious. And the reason why you need that is simple. We know there's such a thing as unconscious perception. So as soon as you grant that we can perceive things subliminally, you've granted that there can be representations throughout the sensory hierarchies, including the intermediate level areas, without consciousness. So the question then becomes, what makes the difference between an intermediate level representation becoming conscious and not being conscious? And I really here was, again, trying to very slavishly follow what I took to be the most robust lessons of the empirical literature. And around the time that I was very concerned with these questions, I began reading about deficits in consciousness. And I was particularly interested in deficits where there were signs of residual visual processing in the absence of consciousness, and I wanted to know what was going on there. And the disorder that impressed me as most illuminating was visual neglect, because in neglect, people really robustly insist that they're not conscious of things on the left side, but nevertheless show evidence of, as some of them do anyway, evidence of processing information on the left side. And neglect had always been understood as a deficit in attention, an attention disorder. So I think that I was intrigued that maybe this was the key to consciousness. The difference between a perceptual representation at the mid-level being conscious and not was the availability of attention to modulate it. And people like Bisiak were writing on this. And in fact, Bisiak was endorsing an intermediate-level theory as well. But a number of other authors that implicated attention. So if you read the first influential paper by Christoph Koch and Francis Crick, they thought attention might be a key here as well. And in the late 90s, a research program on inattentional blindness occurred, which tried to show that even in healthy people, if you remove attention, consciousness seems to go with it. So it was against the background of some patient work, some very theoretical models, and some experimental work with healthy individuals that I began to think attention is a good candidate. And inattentional blindness was interesting because it showed distract somebody away, give them a demanding task that consumes a lot of attention, and then present a stimulus right in clear view, and they will not see it. It turns out that this was just one of many such demonstrations. So there were phenomena like attentional blink, where presenting stimuli in rapid succession seems to lead to a lack of consciousness of the second stimulus. Even phenomena like masking had, it turned out, implicated attention. So people had thought about backwards masking as situations where one stimulus is presented, followed by another that sort of erases or covers that first stimulus, preventing it from becoming conscious. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that if the second stimulus, if the mask, doesn't cover the first, but it's just in the surrounding area, the masking is just as effective. So people like Ensign and DiLallo, who were looking at this, concluded that actually masking is an attentional phenomenon. What's happening is not that the second stimulus erases the first, the trace of the first might still be in the visual system, but it removes attention from the first and doesn't give enough time to the nervous system to attentionally modulate the initial stimulus, because the mask becomes a lure for attention in its own right. So cobbling all these different experimental paradigms together, I concluded, along with many other authors, that attention marks the difference between conscious and unconscious states. And the next task for me in terms of developing this idea was to figure out exactly what attention is. And here I was, again, really trying to look empirically, and attention is a bit of a mess. So people were using the term to refer to a lot of very different kinds of cognitive tasks. So they used attention to refer to pop-out paradigms where one stimulus is salient against a background of contrasting stimuli. They used attention to refer to visual search when people are looking for a specific item. They used attention to refer to states of vigilance where you're watching something, states of tracking where you follow an object as it moves through space. And all of these different things look to be fundamentally different. But what I came to realize, and relying very much on psychologists in the area, is that there is a common denominator here. And the common denominator is that in each of these cases, attention seems to make information in the sensory pathways available to working memory. Attention is a kind of doorway that opens up to the possibility of temporary storage. So the things we're attending to in our sensory surround are the things that we can then hold in memory, think about, manipulate in our minds. The things that we're not attending to are not candidates for that. So for example, in a lovely, very clever, simple old paper, some researchers, including Irvin Rock, who became a central figure in the inattentional blindness work, presented participants with a stimulus that has two oddly shaped kind of curvilinear figures superimposed on top of each other. So people are looking directly at two objects, but they're asked to attend to one of those two objects, not the other. And afterwards, they're given a memory task where they're given an array of objects, and the array includes both the one they were attending to and the one they weren't attending to.
Yeah, this is in your book, too.
This is in the book. And what you find, it's just such a simple study. It's a beautiful design because both stimuli are in the same region of visual field. You can't look at one without looking at the other. But in the memory test, people robustly remember the one they've attended to, but are absolutely hopeless at remembering the one they weren't attending to. So what this suggests to me is that the very act of attending is the difference maker with respect to whether something can get into memory or not. And it was against that kind of research paradigm that I thought we could define attention now in terms of its functional role. And its functional role is some change that allows sensory information to gain access to working memory. So attention is availability.
Okay, so but you also draw a very important distinction at this point of the book between, I guess, availability to working memory and encoding in working memory. And I thought that was a very crucial move that you made in the theory. So could you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is really a move that was driven by the fact that in the memory literature, you have so much work on encoding, on storage, on recall, and very little attention is paid to the situations where something could get into memory and doesn't get there. But that possibility presented itself, and I was really stumped at first. I didn't know, does consciousness actually require the encoding, or does it require mere candidacy for encoding? And this really mattered a lot because around this time period, a debate emerged about whether frontal cortex was involved in consciousness. And there were people who were trying to locate consciousness early in the visual system, denying the importance of frontal cortex, and others, including Crick and Koch in their later collaborations, who insisted that frontal cortex was involved. And I wanted to know the answer. And I think there's an immediate obstacle to answering this question, which is that if you don't get encoding in working memory, you don't get reportability. It's in really working memory that's doing all the work when it comes to explicitly reporting that a stimulus has been seen. So it's almost impossible, it would seem, to test for the existence of consciousness in the absence of working memory encoding. So I at this point was sort of stuck with the possibility that there might be working memory, there might be conscious states that are not in working memory, but merely available to working memory, but could never be confirmed or tested. Yeah. And I turned a corner on this question when I reflected on two phenomena. One of them has to do with the richness of experience. And if you look at the research on what gets encoded in working memory, it looks like the grain of resolution, the representational detail that's preserved, is actually much less rich than the detail we have in conscious experience. So it's as if that very act of encoding is also a kind of streamlining filter that loses information and preserves only a coarse record of what came before. And to that extent, you can immediately see that the working memory encodings are not even in the right grain. They're not the right kinds of representations to account for what we experience consciously. So that already tipped me off that maybe these encodings aren't crucial. The real action, the representations that seem to be in consciousness are the sensory ones. The encodings seem to be of another sort. But the other thing that really convinced me on this was change blindness. So lots have been written about change blindness, and I thought that for the phenomenology of change blindness, the really obvious lesson of change blindness is that the stimuli that are presented are very, very consciously experienced. Every detail of them is consciously experienced. Some change blindness stimuli, so these are these cases where you see one picture followed by another, and there's just something that's changed between the two and you can't detect it. Some of these stimuli are extremely frustrating because you can stare at them for very long periods of time, sometimes hours, without seeing the change. So I started looking at these cases, and I look at them studiously, trying to really find out what's changing. And I noticed that when I did this, I attended to absolutely every corner, every pixel of the picture. And I experienced every pixel of the picture. The whole image was vivid to me. I could experience all of it and still not detect the change. So that suggests that memory is not essential to experience. Change blindness itself can be defined as a memory phenomenon. It's a question of keeping track of how a stimulus is at time one and then comparing it to the stimulus at time two. And if you haven't retained stimulus at time one, then your comparison will fail. Or if you've retained only a coarse record of stimulus at time one, you might miss out on the detail that's changed at time two. So the whole phenomenon of change blindness suggests the possibility of experiencing an image or a stimulus in every detail, attending to it in every detail, but not retaining it in memory. And that cleaves a divide between experience on the one hand and encoding on the other. In each case, when you experience something, you are attending to it. In the change blindness case, you're doing this almost studiously. And in each act of attention, we have independent reason to believe there is some availability to memory. But the fact that change blindness occurs this way suggests that mere availability guarantees experience, but it doesn't guarantee encoding. So I finally ended up with the conclusion that consciousness arises when modulation of attention makes information available to working memory, but doesn't actually require encoding in working memory.
And then this availability, in turn, this is where you bring in the neural part directly, the biological part, where you associate or identify. When the neural realizers of the intermediate representations, the vector waves, as you put it, fire within the gamma frequency. So maybe we could say a word about that final aspect of the theory.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a totally functional description so far. Consciousness arises right. Mid-level. It involves availability to working memory. I was interested in what the underlying neural correlates are. We tend to be sort of phrenological about the brain because we rely so much on fMRI. So we see an area lighting up. That's to us the neuroscience. But of course, that's not the neuroscience. Neuroscience, you know, brains don't work at the level of areas. They work in cellular populations. So it would be good, I thought, to know what's going on when we attend at the cellular level. And one really interesting thing for me about that exercise is when people have posited neural correlates, they haven't always thought about what those neural correlates do. And I have a very mechanistic approach to the mind-brain. So I really was trying to think about what neural correlates could play the relevant functional role. So having arrived at a view about what consciousness does functionally, it makes information available to working memory, I got interested in what neural change could play that role. And it turns out that in the attention literature, there are a number of theories of this, but one theory was that gamma oscillations, that synchronized neural firings within a certain range of frequency, from about 30 hertz upward, is a correlate of attention. And that was really exciting to me, because when I heard gamma, I thought, wow, this rings a bell, because in the early 1990s, people had been positing gamma as the basis of consciousness, the neural correlate of consciousness. And back then, I was absolutely certain that that view was false. I didn't believe it for a minute. And the main reason is I was convinced by some empirical refutations that had been published at the time. And just to just briefly rewind on that, the reason why gamma was proposed had to do with a premise that I think turned out to be false. And the premise was that consciousness requires binding of information together, feature binding.
Right.
And then the next premise was that gamma is the mechanism by which features are bound together. And I came to believe that both of these premises are false, that there can be bound information outside of consciousness, like if you unconsciously perceive a word in a mass priming study. There can be unbound information in consciousness. So people with various kinds of associative agnosia sometimes experience the world as unbound. And likewise, gamma, various studies of cell recordings suggested, wasn't particularly strongly associated with binding. So both premises that were crucial to the gamma theory of consciousness were false. But here gamma appeared again. But now gamma wasn't doing binding, it was doing attention. And it was a perfect candidate for attention, because if you think about gamma, it's you can think about it as a way of creating signal in a noisy system. So all these cells are firing separately, but when you get a bunch of cells firing in synchrony, they are in a very good position to communicate with other parts of the brain. So a gamma process, or specifically a synchrony process, seemed like a perfect candidate for implementing this theory of attention, according to which attention is availability. By firing together, cells become much more available for long-distance communication. And there were correlational studies now suggesting gamma comes with attention, so all the pieces suddenly fell into place.
So one of the things that you've just described is in fact, a case of what you later in the book actually put forward as a particular new mind-body theory or metaphysical position, which you call neurofunctionalism. And that theory you put forward as a neither reductive nor non-reductive view of physicalism, where you kind of take some insights both from the functionalists and from the reductive physicalists to sort of formulate a multi-level theory. And in fact, your theory of consciousness is such a theory. Could you explain the relationship of neurofunctionalism to the other standard views in the literature?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we really all in our philosophy of mind textbooks were taught that there were two materialist theories of the mind, and one was functionalism and the other was some kind of psychophysical identity theory, and we had to choose between them. And I think a number of people, you among them, started thinking that maybe this isn't such a good dichotomy, that there might be positions in between these. And if you look at the core arguments for each of these views, they're really problematic. So I think if you think about the literature on functionalism, functionalists characteristically tried to argue against identity theory by developing these very elaborate thought experiments that involved pumping intuitions about whether the nation of China would instantiate a qualitative state if everybody started talking to each other through walkie-talkies, or would a Martian with a very different nervous system have consciousness where the intuition was supposed to be, of course they would. So in the China case, the intuition is, of course they wouldn't. And these two things are supposed to cut a lot of ice in deciding which metaphysics of mind is right. So Nation of China was designed to show that the stuff that is used to make up the mind, the structure, matters. And the Martian thought experiments were designed to show that no, structure doesn't matter. It's the functional role that matters. So the use of thought experiments in this domain had led to kind of conflicting conclusions. But I think when you step back and ask, why should we trust our intuitions about whether the nation of China instantiates qualia or whether Martians have qualia, it immediately becomes obvious that we shouldn't. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why our intuition should be a reliable guide to these questions that have to do with unusual forms of implementation. So we kind of found ourselves in this position in terms of theory construction, where the two major views, psychophysical identity theory and functionalism, were under-supported by the methods that philosophers were using. And I think a much more straightforward method for trying to figure out whether functionalism is true or physicalism is true is the kind of method that's used in science quite pervasively, which is a difference maker method. Which of these things makes a difference? Can you manipulate the functional level and still have consciousness? Can you manipulate the physical level, some level described in the language of neuroscience, and leave consciousness intact, and settle the answer empirically? And I think once you take on that as your methodology, a striking thing happens. You start to realize that the felt urgency about picking the right level simply dissipates, and the possibility that multiple levels matter presents itself. So in my own groping towards a theory, I had been looking at psychological evidence that suggested that a certain kinds of functional role was important to consciousness. I'd been looking at neuroscientific evidence at a cellular level, suggesting there were particular neural processes that were implicated in consciousness. And these different methodologies were suggesting that both levels might be important. Another thing that was happening in philosophical theory that was relevant to this, I think, emerging sea change is in philosophy of science, there had been the emergence of the mechanistic turn, of a shift towards theories of explanation that said what we really try and do in understanding a complex system is decompose it into its parts, and then those parts decompose further and further into smaller parts. And the notion of mechanism as a set of nested structures that implement increasingly complex structures that ultimately produce observable behavior or activity fit so nicely with this multi-level picture. Because in addition to just the very, I think one might say, inert a correlational method where you show, okay, there are things that make a difference at the functional level, things that make a difference at the physical level, the mechanistic story showed that there's also a deeper sense in which these levels are not independent, right, which is that they're related through mechanistic relations. So not only is the sort of sense that we need to choose between the functional and physical not required, but a mechanistic perspective suggests that it's the very nature of these lower physical levels that they just implement higher and higher physical levels, levels that could ultimately be characterized in psychological terms familiar to the functionalist research tradition. So consciousness, I thought, like everything else that we're interested in, is a kind of mechanism. It's a mechanism that can be described at different levels. The levels are not arbitrarily related. One implements the other. And both levels or many levels are going to turn out to be important. And in the book, I call this neurofunctionalism, and I define neurofunctionalism as the view that the identity conditions for the phenomenon in question, in this case, conscious experience, reside at both a level described in the language of neuroscience and a level that could be characterized as functional, described in the language of psychology.
Okay, so another thing that you had that you mentioned earlier was this idea of binding. And in the book, you also, there's two different questions related to the idea of binding. One is the idea of the unity of consciousness. And then there's this other idea that the self, right, which sometimes the idea that there's a phenomenal self and that this self is essential to the unity of consciousness that explains it or not. I mean, depending on your position, on one's position. And so one of the one of the interesting things that you argue against here is this idea of a phenomenal self that is always represented in consciousness. And I think you think it's never represented, right? So could you explain that view of the self and its relationship to your air theory?
Absolutely. And this also harks back a little bit, because I, before doing philosophy of mind, was interested in philosophy of language. And one of the topics that had interested me briefly in my student days was Wittgenstein on the first person. And Anscombe also wrote an important paper on the first person. And a distinction that emerges in that literature is between a use of the word I that is subjective and another use that's objective. So if I say something like, I need to shave, or something referring to my body, the I there is treating the self as a kind of object. It's an item that gets experienced and manipulated. It's not the agent that does the experiencing or does the manipulating. And when I say something like, I'm in pain, or I want to spend the afternoon reading in the park, the I there is an I as subject. It's an expression that refers to the agent who is supposed to be the one doing activities and subject to the experiences. And I think that the question I was interested in this chapter is whether there is such a thing as a phenomenal I in that subjective sense. So they take the kind of Cartesian formulation of the cogito and say, I am thinking, or I am experiencing. Clearly there is a phenomenology to the thought or to the experience, but is there also a phenomenology to the I, the haver of that thought or experience? And that I thought it was a question I really didn't have an antecedent answer to. I just wanted to know. And I had been focusing on perceptual theories of consciousness. So I wanted to know, is the I in consciousness at all? And if so, is it something that can be reducible to perception, as some people have argued? Is it, for instance, an experience of control of one's body? Or is the I something above and beyond perception, a phenomenal quality that that outstrips perceptual content? And I came to think that it's neither of these things, and that it doesn't exist. So the skepticism about the I is really, it's kind of the output of a failed search. You look in the content of experience, and this was Hume's point in a way,
right.
And you don't see anything above and beyond all those sensory states, the ongoing verbal narrative describing those states that could be called the I. There's nothing above and beyond the flow of the contents of experience that looks like the subject. And even searching the classic philosophical literature, you see someone like Kant talking about a transcendental unity of apperception, but it doesn't look like an item in experience for Kant. It looks more like the very unity of experience. You look for evidence in Descartes, and while there's a kind of naive reading of him that suggests the subject is present, that made him very vulnerable to certain kind of ridicule from critics like Lichtenberg, I think what you really see there is there's also a kind of failure to commit to the existence of anything like a phenomenal I. So I think in the end of this exercise, it's always hard to prove a negation, but in the end of this exercise, I was convinced that there was nothing left to explain with respect to phenomenology once we'd given an account of perceptual phenomenology. And any impression that there's an I above and beyond experience could be explained away.
So let me. We're close to running out of time, and I wanted to discuss your new response to the Jackson's knowledge argument with Mary in the Black and White Room. But I'd rather ask about an issue that occurred to me as I was reading. What implications your theory has for consciousness in other animals? Given that if you are explaining consciousness in a way that is very closely related to perception, other animals have all those capacities, right? There's nothing. There's nothing that that we have that they don't have in terms of perceptual capacities. And that suggests that consciousness extends farther down the phylum than many people are willing to agree, at least intuitively. Of course, Descartes cut it off right away. But even nowadays, people say, well, you know, shrimp are not conscious, and worms are not conscious, or insects, and so forth. How do you see your theory as affecting that debate about the consciousness of animals?
I think it's a really, really interesting debate, and I was going to have a chapter on it. When I first put together a book proposal, I actually had a planned chapter on animal consciousness. And in researching that chapter, I really read deeply into that literature. And the strategy was, predictably, let me take this independently motivated theory of human consciousness and just see what creatures satisfy it. Mm-hmm. And I ended up not including the chapter. I did in part because some of the relevant science was still so undeveloped. So we really end up with a lot of studies suggesting things like, if you look at say, squid and ask, does it have attention, or a fruit fly, you'll see papers where they deliver a positive answer, yes. But then you actually look at what the papers report, and they report that the fruit fly or the squid change their orientation when there's a stimulus of importance. And a central theoretical division in the book that does a fair amount of work for me is the distinction between orientation and attention. So, for instance, there's now a big cottage industry of trying to prove that attention and consciousness are dissociable. And in reviewing those studies that purport to show attention in the absence of consciousness, I again and again found that a more natural explanation of the results is that there can be orientation in the absence of consciousness. And I define orientation in a change in the mechanisms that allow information to get into the nervous system. Internally, orientation might involve a change in the motor plans to shift one's direction of gaze or one's body to affect what information gets in. So mm-hmm. orientation is all about what gets into the system. Attention, on the other hand, is really about the stuff that's already in the system. Attention is something that you do to manipulate what stuff in the system can flow forward to work memory. And the two usually work together. So if you're, say, interested in tracking an object, what you want to do is track it with your eyes. That's orienting. But also make sure that when that information gets in, that's the stuff you process, think about, make decisions about. But they can come apart. So given the possibility of dissociation, it's always open to the theorist to explain the animal results by saying these creatures are orienting but not attending.
Right.
And I think when you're dealing with organisms that don't have a tremendous amount of flexibility in their behavior, the claim that they have working memory that functions the way ours does is somewhat, if not dubious, at least would require considerably more exploration and defense. And I wasn't convinced the science was settled enough to draw any strong conclusions. What I do think, though, is we do find tremendous preservation in evolution. So if you just look across phyla, the insects that we have examined use neurotransmitters that are similar chemically to ones that we find in mammal brains. I mean, it's really tremendous preservation across living things. And to that extent, even if you do think that there are strong correlations between consciousness and specific neural realizers, the possibility that we might find consciousness in creatures quite different from us in our world is, I think, fairly high. And I am convinced that probably every mammal has consciousness, because I think probably every mammal has a nervous system that's sufficiently similar to ours with respect to the presence of gamma oscillations leading to availability to working memory. When it comes to, shellfish, when it comes to insects, I think that all bets are off at this point with respect to what we currently know. But given continuity, It's a really, really important and interesting area for further exploration.
So we're running out of time. And speaking of further explanation, what's your next project?
Well, I just finished a book draft on art, so pretty far removed from the consciousness topic. Everything for me is interconnected by an interest in perception, an interest in experience. And I'm now in early stages of two other projects. One is revisiting my earliest book topic, which is concepts. So I'm thinking again about the relationship between concepts and perception and writing about that. And the other is a return to moral psychology and thinking a lot about not just moral judgment, which has typically been the focus of moral psychology, but the relationship between moral values and the self. And there I'm very interested in an idea that morality is fundamentally tribal and identity is fundamentally social, in the sense that we develop a sense of who we are by forming affiliations with various moral tribes. So far afield from consciousness, though, you know, like everything in one's research, these topics tend to stay with you. And I certainly am continuing to think about topics in consciousness studies as well.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you very much for a wonderful interview.
Thanks, Carol.
And I'll be in touch for some of your future work, hopefully.
Thanks. And likewise, I should say to listeners, those of you who haven't read your stuff, read it. And there's tremendously rich and interesting work you've done on the relationship between mind and brain that I think really, if people read that in their intro courses instead of some of the thought experiment-based classics, we'd have a much more nuanced view of the mind-body relation than you and I were forced to accept while studying philosophy of mind in early days.
Well, thank you. So, bye.
Bye. Thank you.
You've been listening to my interview with Jesse Prinz, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the City University of New York Graduate Center. We've been talking about his new book, The Conscious Brain, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed our podcast, and thank you for listening.